Welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to Literature Online. This is show number 152. Joy is a product of unity. A conversation with Gregory Alexander about his poetry and his book, Call Them Home. It's a midsummer evening. You may hear crickets or fireworks in the background. Greg Alexander has been a poet since the age of 13. He studied English and world literature at Middlebury College, the University of California at Berkeley, and Columbia University. He lived on the West Coast for 19 years and earned his doctorate in counseling psychology at the University of Oregon in 1984. Since then, he has been living on Long Island, New York, where he worked as a staff psychologist in a Department of Veterans Affairs hospital for 25 years. He is currently in private practice. Greg's father, Joseph, with an F, was a composer, and his mother, Hannah, was a published poet and his mentor. Greg has participated in several Walt Whitman Birthplace Association master classes in poetry on Long Island. He is married and has two grown sons. And Call Them Home, published by All Book Books, is his first book of poems. This is your host, Monk. Thank you for listening. Welcome, Greg Alexander, to Between the Lines. Thanks for being here today. We're sitting inside, but it's a nice summer day, and we can hear little birds chirping in the background. So how are you feeling today?
Good.
Good.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yes, yes. This book was published by All Book Books and took 2 or 3 years, I think, to cull the amount of poems, and it was a lot of back and forth. And a lot of editing and fine-tuning, and I learned a lot as well as you. So it really is a team effort that, you know, went into the editing of the poems. Well, let's jump into the first question. I know, because you have mentioned how much your mom has several books of poetry, or she wrote a lot. And how did she, you know, I think at what age did you start, you know, like being aware of poetry, and, you know, how did she affect your poetry, other than just opening the door for you, so to speak? Was there any specific way she affected your poetry?
Yes. I think I was about 10 or 11 years old, and I had written a poem related to the sea. I was very interested in sea stories at that time, and I read a lot of them. And I wrote this poem inspired by, I guess, my reading, or something else. I'm not quite sure what it might have been that inspired me. But in any case, I brought it to my mom, and she liked it, and she encouraged me to enter it into a contest run by Scholastic, Children's Scholastic Magazine.
Oh, yeah, I remember that one.
And won second prize.
Wow.
So my mother helped me with the title of the poem, and she was a great support in terms of assisting me in editing it and getting it ready for a submission.
So was the poetry kind of in the family before? Like, did your mom, was she one of the first, do you know how far back sort of interest in poetry went, or just that your mom got into it?
That's a good question. I think it was my mom.
Okay.
I think she got into poetry at a very young age.
Wow.
And she majored in classical studies, languages, and literature at William and Mary College.
Okay.
So she wrote poetry from high school on herself.
So was she, as you started writing, like around 10, age 10, you said, it just went from there, ongoing, or was it, sporadic?
It was more sporadic.
Okay.
It really, my poetry writing really took a big jump when I was in high school.
Okay.
And it was, I met a friend named Bruce, and we used to write poetry together, and that's where it really took off, and I've been writing ever since then.
That's neat to hear about, two guys in high school writing poetry together.
Yeah.
It's this sort of stereotypical, angsty women, high school stuff.
It was a nice friendship.
That's good. Did you always kind of run to your mom to show her the poem, or was it more of like, in your, keep a stash in your room?
I would say that it was many years before I really started to share my poetic efforts with my mother again.
Okay.
It was several years. That's what I remember.
And then by the time you matured as a writer, did she, did you get to share some of that with her?
Yes, I did, nice. Monk. She was a great support to me, and I would say that a very meaningful event along those lines took place when my mother invited me to be a fellow fellow featured poet at the Donlisle Library in New York, opposite, at that time it was opposite the Museum of Modern Art. It's now been taken over by something else, but we had a poetry reading there, and she asked a friend of hers who was an actress to read both of our poetry, and that's what this friend of hers did, and it was a really wonderful moment.
What about your dad? Was he in on this at all?
My father was always in on the creative efforts because he was a very creative man himself. He was a composer of modern American music, and he's not too well known today, but he wrote a great deal of music, and he was a professor at Brooklyn College. So my father was very interested in poetry. He set a lot of his music to poetry, including a poem of Walt Whitman's, Song of Myself.
Okay. That's a long one.
So my father loved poetry.
That's great. That's great to hear because some people I know in poetry community, sometimes, I hear comments like the family just doesn't get it or won't even, you write poetry. They get almost, scoffed at or laughed at a bit. So it's nice to hear a story where, there was encouragement from the get-go and obviously, affects your poetry in a nice way, which we'll get back to. I want to kind of go another track because you're a, I forgot the exact title, psychologist?
Psychologist.
Okay, I didn't.
Yes.
And when I saw you read at a local bookstore, you were describing your background and how it was like having three jobs at a clinic and a regular practice and sort of like you were scribbling poems in the car in between. But I'm interested to know how much the psychology background has affected, the poetry, maybe, how consciously or not consciously, not trying to make a psychological pun here, but how much, because I notice it in your in some of the poems in Call Them Home, you take on different personas.
Yes.
Which is fascinating. One's a little girl, another's a Navy guy in a submarine and looking at his, whether he has these homosexual tendencies, and another one's a younger woman, and there's some other sexual content into it.
Yes.
But it's like pretty adept at, jumping into these personas. So that, that could be just your natural trait, like a script writer, but it made me wonder, you know, have the psychology background, you know, if you're aware of it or just it happens naturally?
I would say both are true, Monk. I feel that my ability to empathize with people, to identify with them, and to speak as if I were them is a talent that I've been blessed with. And sometimes it doesn't feel like a blessing. Sometimes it's very hard to have that ability. But I'd say that's what really allows me to write the persona poems. And it's the same skill that goes into being an effective psychologist from my point of view. Like being able to be empathic.
Sort of, yeah, put yourself in the other person's shoes a bit.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. And do you ever, I mean, maybe you wouldn't want to say, but like, does there ever have a client where it's like, oh my God, that stuff's like perfect for a poem, or that sort of, you're not, you wouldn't do that, you know, you wouldn't touch that?
That's 100% right on, Monk, in the positive department. Yes, because a lot of my poetry has been inspired by my clients.
Oh, it has. Okay.
That's why I dedicate the book to my clients in private practice and the veterans with whom I worked at the Northport Hospital, Veterans Hospital.
So it's almost like the reader gets to learn sort of first, second hand. I'm just sort of thinking out loud, like from a psychologist, poet, they're like getting some sort of inside, you know, a little bit more maybe inside than inside information, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's interesting.
I think that's true. And there's a poem in here that was directly inspired by one of my clients. I won't say any more about it, but the poem is called The Drunken Sailor.
You want to read that one out?
Sure, yeah. I can read that one. Yeah. Absolutely. Just one moment, please.
Yeah, take your time.
Here it is.
Okay, all right. This is called The Drunken Sailor.
The Drunken Sailor, inspired by a client of mine. I live pillar to post, like a drunken sailor. Sometimes lose all track among errands. Realize I'm here when I thought I was there. Bank, grocery store, offices, meld together. Punching bag for my husband, lands some blows and demands from the grown kids. Push-pulled to act for them among agencies. I'm a marionette in their sideshow. Wish I were unencumbered, a north wind to wake me up, free beyond the lee of land. How can I find a real self answering to my name amidst these mists? I become intoxicated by semi-selves that aren't me too long. Wake with my identity trailing behind like a wake, frothy, with empty patches, back to yesterday. Can I write myself after these gales? I'm tattered, a ripped old sail. My garments show inexplicable gashes and holes that somehow got there with little pieces of me lost day by day. Should I put out a missing person's report to call me home? I've forgotten when the ship to sanity departs. Cling to the railing of today's schedule in unrelenting wind under a dim, half-clouded sun.
Oh, very nicely read, Greg.
Thank you, Monk.
And it's kind of, I think it's apropos to maybe almost anybody's sort of average day at some points. I mean, sometimes I just do a few errands and I come home and I'm like, you know, who am I? Because sometimes the mundane or the energy of all the people and stuff, it's like, you know, I have to adjust my head a bit, even just from a few errands. So
definitely,
you know, having a busy schedule, I think anybody could relate to that, even though the actual topic may be sort of, you know, it definitely comes through. There's more of a sort of psychological identity thing going on.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And, yeah, it's a nice blend of kind of that psychological study and then like the amidst in the mist or something. You know, this like little poetic touch comes in,
mm-hmm.
like reminds me it's a poem, you know, in a good way. Not that it's not a poem, but so it's a nice blend of metaphor and the storyline.
Thank you, Monk.
So how much, like, is there any kind of sense of, I didn't look over the book and say, like, oh, there's 20% of the poems like that, but do you recognize, like, when you start to write a sort of, I call it like a persona poem, it's, do you set out to write that, or is it kind of like all of a sudden the voice starts, you know, writing in that fashion?
More the latter.
Yeah, it just kind of happens.
Yes. A voice in me starts to speak. And while it's part of my voice, while it's my voice definitely, it also is in some way that I can recognize a voice differentiated from me.
Mm-hmm.
The voice of a person or something in nature,
mm-hmm,
speaking to me.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a very, native or whatever. Just being open to whatever way is that anything can speak.
Yes.
It's not just a persona. The trees are people, the birds, whatever. And, you know, there's a lot of great literature from that vantage point. Now, it's the voices thing is fascinating. And I'm fascinated with you, as a friend and psychologist and poet, because I get to ask you questions because that mm-hmm. whole psychology topic fascinates me. Is there any kind of borderline, or have you ever dealt with anybody? Because, you know, that there's that saying, like, something about genius and madness are not too far off. Because, you know, poets and probably all artists hear voices.
Yes.
And I think I've written one or two sonnets. One was sort of like a satirical one, but the one genuine one, which I really love, I went into the bathroom one day and I just heard, like, I heard a voice in it. I think it starts off, this quiet I have often felt alone. And it was my head tilted. I was like, da 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 da. And I was like, I think this is a sonnet. And I just, you know, wrote the sonnet right there. So is there any, have you ever dealt with anybody in your practice where you almost encouraged them to write? Or it was that borderline between, not to make fun of it, but borderline between crazy and artistic?
Definitely there is, yes. there's a yearly... or used to be a yearly program seminar for therapists that was held usually out west, I think, in New Mexico, called Creativity and Madness.
Hmm. Well,
I never went to it, but I loved the title of it, and I used to read the brochures about it avidly. I wonder if it's still going on. But yes, there's a very real connection. And I think the key is the degree to which your various selves are integrated. I'm looking for a quote that I wanted to share with you,
mm-hmm.
And say in this interview, because it's something that really, when I encountered it recently, and I'll say where I encountered this quote, it was in a DVD that I was watching, mm-hmm. called Any Human Heart, about a guy who originally was a novelist, and then he became an art gallery dealer. And the narrator in the film says, every human being is a collection of selves.
Hmm. Nice.
So I think there's a lot of truth to that. Now, just one more thought. What I think might separate somebody who, so to speak, is losing his marbles, her marbles, as the case may be, and somebody who's a creative person who is writing from these different voices, these different parts of oneself, is how well integrated they are.
Mm-hmm.
How well are these parts of oneself able to communicate with one another? Or are they at such disparity or so alienated from each other that they can't and are not communicating at all?
Yeah, I think I could talk about this, all day. It's, yeah, I think that you touched on the key there. It's sort of, I don't know what sort of the answer is, but there's that, how do you get there specifically would take a whole discussion. But I think it's the awareness of that. It's sort of like being a manager of a bunch of selves, you know, your own selves, or the awareness that this is another part of me, and being able to kind of manage all that is maybe one of the keys of kind of distinguishing between, sort of consciously to go into a character rather than to go into it and lose oneself, I guess, you know, as some actors do.
Yes.
You know, some actors can, you know, just get into it so much that they do. They have no sense of self other than that. And other actors, you know, I've seen where they're just like rehearsing Shakespeare and then it's cut and then they're like, hey, get me a ham sandwich. You know, they turn it off and on like that.
Yes.
So it's an interesting, fascinating topic. I'll throw in a pitch for the, just started the online, I did an interview with a writer and publisher, and she's also a medium, Mary Jo Moore. And it was the first written interview. It's on the website, on the All Book Books website. And I'm thinking of this because she has a little book called Confessions of a Mad Woman, and her, you know, her poems touch on that whole topic. So
yes.
You know, I think a lot of it has to do with that, you know, conscious, the awareness of all that. So I want to talk about that more, but we'll go off and that would be another hour. So
yes.
Let's see. Well, let's shift to a more technical thing because it made it easier for me as an editor publisher. There's virtually no punctuation in your poems.
Yes.
So I know of another Long Island writer that does that frequently, and I admire the style. It's a lot. Sometimes it's like all lowercase and no punctuation. It, you know, really makes things simple in a way. But you know, there's pluses and minuses. But you handle it very well. How did you? Did you stumble upon that, or was it, you know, how did you get to that?
It's an excellent question, Monk. I'm not fully sure how I got there, but I believe I was influenced by a number of poets. Two of my favorite American poets are E. Cummings and William Carlos Williams.
Okay.
And both of them write poetry without a lot of punctuation. Perhaps they use it a little more than I do, but then I have a poet that I very much admire, a Mexican poet named Octavio Paz.
Oh yeah, he's well known.
Who also writes poetry without very much punctuation. My feeling is that poetry is best as crafted natural speech. And to me, a lot of commas, which is my least liked punctuation mark. Commas break poems where the end of the line is a natural break. So I use the end of the line as a natural break. And not always. Sometimes my end of the line and beginning of the next line run together.
Yeah, you can mess around with the rhythm of it when you want it.
Yes.
You know, jam it or flow it, whatever way, yeah.
Yes. So to me, that style most represents human speech and also human thought.
Yeah, that you touched on a deep thing because I've been learning about language from Native people, and the one of the things I was realizing was like how much just what you said, it's like the whole thing of grammar seems in a way, I mean, it's helpful in a way. If I'm writing an essay, it's helpful to structure, but you know, it seems very forced in some ways. Like, you know, do we think in, you know, how often do we use commas when we're thinking? We may pause, but you know, I think the mind tends to run on and on sometimes in a difficult way, but also sometimes in a natural, you know, in a way that's a natural flow. So
yes,
you know, in that way, the poetry kind of emulates, you know, like you said, the just like the natural mode more than trying to force it into a mold. Which a lot of time, even the whole sentence structure of like subject and object, which is very sort of dominating. Like native languages, they're non hierarchical, so they speak. Mary Jo had mentioned to me, learning from a Cherokee elder, how, you know, you wouldn't necessarily say, I'm paraphrasing, like, I saw or I see a bear, because you would respect the bear enough to say you saw the bear go, the bear gets respect first. So it'd be more like bear saw I. So you know, there goes the English, you know, grammar goes out the window. So it's a fascinating topic of, you know, how you mess with language without making it seem maybe too crafty. Like, E. Cummings is great, but sometimes, you know, it's definitely like he's sort of shouting, I'm experimenting in a way, which sometimes really works well, but it's hard to sort of pull that off a lot as a modern poet without sometimes overdoing it. Oh, you want to read it? You want to read another one maybe that kind of fits that mold of because some of them are like in shorter stanzas and it fits more of the poetic mold, and other ones are kind of long-winded monologues almost. So maybe pick one that's a little longer winded, or just has that sort of nonstop flow.
Sure. Just a moment.
Sure.
Let's see. One of the ones that I thought I'd read, which is also a persona poem, I'll have to find it, is this is a bit of a longer poem, and it is one of what you've called a persona poem, and it's called The Tape.
Okay.
And this, of course, is referring back to the old days when people listened to tapes of music and so forth, and taped things.
Oh, yeah, not
which people
the
still do.
The reel
of
to
course.
Reel stuff.
Pardon me?
You mean reel to reel or before the cassette tape?
No, compact, tape players.
Cassette tape.
Yes, cassette tape.
I still do in the while driving sometimes. I still have cassettes.
Yes, that's great. So that's what this is referring to, the tape. The tape I made at the concert that ended the church service. Her songs, pearly, crisp, no vibrato on the high notes, but legato through a long, multi-part melody. Certain rooms in me were unlocked by the key of her voice, now revived from long sleep, stumbled naked up the cellar stairs. Freed, I felt younger, unburdened, the leaden suit peeled off, buoyed by a gust of wind that bent the cottonwoods, blew like an elixir through the camper window as I drove. So when leaving San Antonio, uncertain about my return, I'd become nomadic. I took it with me to remember my life there. At special times, in evening only, took it out as one might a photo of a lover long lost from under the pile of books and CDs. Created a ritual when I listened. First, tidy the piles on the coffee table just right. Second, dim the lights to an afterglow. Third, arrange myself, palms up, cupped in each other on my lap, eyelids fluttering as I closed them. When I pushed play, the first bars began the soaring that reached like arches of octaves, till at the pinnacle I departed, as if in a nimbus of incandescence, as her face came back to me, serene, Olympian, and resplendent, her chin tilted, her mouth a chalice receiving from above, and pouring truth like rain upon those rapt, expectant.
Very nice. Yeah, I remember when I read that before a while ago, and there's like a touch of that madness we're talking about in it, because it's almost like this teenager feeling of infatuation, where you hear this woman singing and you make the tape and then you set it all up to listen. So there's that feeling of that arts and madness, kind of in a conscious way, setting up this ecstatic experience.
Exactly, Monk. Yes, that's what the dramatic speaker in the poem is describing, as an ecstatic experience. And that brings to mind Abraham Maslow's well-known term of a peak experience.
Oh, okay.
For him, hearing that singer in the church was a peak experience, and he re-experienced it whenever he played this tape.
Excellent. Yeah, I like, you reminded me of, there's a wonderful book called Original Thinking by Glenn Aparicio Perry, and it comes out of conferences with Native people and Western scientists mm-hmm. talking together, and there's one section in there where he talks about, I think the phrase is like a sweet spot, you know, that sweet spot, whether it's the baseball bat or the, you know, the evening where you're hanging out and all of a sudden everything just kind of, it's how a lot of life, you know, it's like something you can't really plan for, but everybody wants, and you hope you get there at least once every day. It's like things just kind of all come together. Mm-hmm. It's like a magical thing, and it's almost like the more we do the things that help create that, the better our lives are. You know, like your poem with you made the tape and you sat a certain way, and it's like you're creating the circumstances for that sweet spot, that peak experience to happen.
That's right. So. Yes, I think one does have to create the circumstances for these peak experiences to occur.
Maybe real brief, can you say like what the peak experience according to Maslow, was it like that this happens naturally or that people crave it or something like that?
I think the peak experience for Maslow was some genre or type of the oceanic experience. The oceanic experience is one where the boundaries between people and between oneself and the natural world and between oneself and the spiritual world break down. Mm-hmm. And there's unity, there's mm-hmm. greater feeling of unity and connection and therefore joy, because from everything we can learn about the spiritual states of being, joy is a byproduct of unity and increasing unity, speaking very, very metaphorically.
That's
and
a great
archetypally.
Phrase. I love that. Joy is a byproduct of unity?
Yes.
Wow, that's a great quote right there. I got to think about that one for a bit, because, yeah. I mean, you're talking about that peak experience, and then, you know, it brings back to that artist madness topic of, because, like, you know, arts is sort of like a non-drug high in a lot of ways, and perhaps some of the troubles artists have with it is that there's a high, but it only lasts for so long. That creative burst, sometimes if you're lucky, it goes on for a while, you know, like working on a whole book. But still, there has to be balance. So it's another sort of psychological thing. Anything you want to comment on that? Like, you know, that balancing point of, you know, like craving that peak experience and yet being able to deal with it when it's not there. Seems like the healthy artist, in quotes.
That's a real challenge. One could, and I would like to, bring in the concept of the dark night of the soul here.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
because
yeah.
The dark night of the soul is something that I think every creative person has experienced.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when these peak experiences are not happening. There's not a feeling of unity. There's a feeling of isolation, separation, and alienation.
That's when the peak experiences are happening?
No, that's the opposite.
Oh, okay, right.
When those feelings are occurring, the alienation, mm-hmm. the separation, the individual mundane self, that's when the person longs for these peak experiences. And they're not always readily available.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's almost like, I don't know, you know, you're working on a new book of poems, but maybe poems or maybe even a psychological pamphlet or something. That would make, I just had an idea for you for a book. Joy is a product of unity, because it's got me thinking, you know, and how much in the culture where there's so much fixation on, you know, whether it's buying something or the sort of, you know, that sort of specific joy experience. It's like, you know, oh, we went on a cruise for a week, or we did this, or we had a great dinner, which could be nice things, but a lot of times that sort of, it's almost like this cultural hunger for the joy experience, at, you know, while overlooking the simpler connections with people that, you know, that the unity brings about. You know, it can be as simple as, you know, having a cup of tea outside on a nice day.
Definitely.
That's like a unity without having to, you know, make it all fancy. So that's a, yeah, so I don't know, man.
I agree.
You can take that idea and and run with it if you want, or I might do something.
Well, I would like to read another poem.
Sure.
Because this poem is another manifestation of the peak experience.
Okay.
And it's in several senses, both a mundane sense and a spiritual sense. Top of the hill. Ironically, but symbolically, this peak experience happens on the top of the hill. Attempts to describe the peak experience. Ultimately, these peak experiences are indescribable.
Exactly. Yeah.
By their very nature. Top of the hill. What happens at the top of the hill? Head pulled off. Ecstasy for moments, brilliantine white. Because the legs that push up continue through spine and pineal into ethers. The call arises, my body a minaret, cloud piercing, shouts, and the voice speaks. Doors fall, dominoes in succession. Disclose myself, unreserved. Mists pull back. The expanse, clear, sparkling. Light tower blazes to light tower. Bubbles of brightness break. Fountain me up as drink, as froth, as a riddle answered.
that's a fun poem. It's like a lot of things. It reminded me of like a movie scene and... I like that line, fountain me up. Now, brilliantine, I mean, I don't care if you made it up. That's a great word, but is that a real word?
It is a real word.
Brilliantine.
Yeah, yeah, it means a kind of oily white.
Huh.
Shiny white.
Okay, yeah, it reminded me of adamantine. I think that means
adamantine.
Like strong or hard.
Iron,
like
yes.
Hard as a, because
yes.
Adam is like from the earth. Hard as a rock or something like that.
Yes.
From a gem.
Adamant.
Yeah, neat.
Yes.
Yeah,
it is a word. It is a word, and I felt it fit there.
Yeah, I like the dominoes in there too. Just trying to, just sort of. That's what I meant by sort of movie. Is these random little images or visuals that sometimes a movie character, you know, they show what's going on in the head.
Yes.
Now you have like you. I haven't seen it, but you've told me you have an extensive book collection.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that bibliophile, which a lot of writers are. How does that feed your poetry? Because I know sometimes I'm just like reading this, that, and the other thing, and part of it is enjoying the reading, but part of it is it's sort of literally feels like, you know, I'm it's like feeding, sopping up this stuff, and I'm gonna like spit it back out in my own variation.
Yes.
So how does that work for you?
I feel inspired by. Art of all kinds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of your poems specifically refer to a piece of art, which is neat. The book is like a, it's almost like a, it's like a, you know, when you go to the museum and they give you a thing to go around with, mm-hmm. So your book is good for that.
Thank you. I'm using the word art to include paintings and drawings, mm-hmm. and sculpture, and also literature, music, the arts in general, the muses. The creations of the muses.
Right.
All of it inspires me. For example, about half a year ago, I got into F. Scott Fitzgerald's novels. I reread The Great Gatsby.
Mm-hmm.
I read several other of his novels, and I have one now that I'm going to be reading soon, The Beautiful and the Damned. And two phrases from one of his novels inspired me.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote whole poems just inspired by quotes from those novels.
That's great.
Poetry, sometimes just a phrase or even a whole poem inspires me. I know many of Rainer Maria Rilke's poems have inspired me. So I'm a voracious reader. I'm usually reading about 3 or 4 books at once. And books of all kinds can inspire me, including religious books. For example, there's one poem in here that was inspired by something that I found in the New Testament, Damaris's Meditation.
Oh, yeah.
And that was just mentioned. Her name was just mentioned in one of Paul's letters, and I felt inspired by her, by her name, and by the description of her situation. So, certainly, spiritual writing can inspire me as well. I would say it's a combination of inspiration from not only nature, from what's going on in the world, but definitely from the arts and the reading that I do.
It sounds like a very holistic and healthy model for any artist, just, you know, life. Basically, arts, what's going on in the world. Some of the poems in Call Them Home, or you touch on the, you know, global warming. So it's just, you know, really just to be open-hearted, open-minded to everything is a way to feed one's art.
Yes.
And have a good, you know, enjoy life while you're doing it. You know, sort of break the suffering artist stereotype a bit there. So you've told me you're working on your next book already.
Yes.
Can you say a little bit about any direction that's going?
Well, so far I've collected about 75 of my poems that I like, and some of them are longer poems than in the first book, Call Them Home. They're longer poems because they're poems inspired by a whole art show. In other words, either an artist or a collection of paintings on a particular theme. So that would be a difference if we decide, you and I, to publish these longer poems, which are actually collections of shorter poems tied to a particular artist like Van Gogh or Gauguin or James Ensor or Odilon Redon or Juan Miró. These are all artists who have inspired me to write a series of poems. And most recently, Lucas Samaras, who did some beautiful pastels that I saw in New York City. That would be one, perhaps, difference. Poems that are longer than a collection of shorter poems inspired by a particular artist. Generally speaking, though, I would say my style is fairly much the same. Mm-hmm. I play around with punctuation. For example, in this book, I want to show it to you and see what you think, but I have a poem that has, it's a one-word poem.
Oh, okay.
And it is, the only word in the poem is the title. The rest of the poem is all punctuation marks.
Okay. That definitely sounds E. Cumming-esque.
yeah. I think it was somewhat inspired by his playfulness.
All right. That's neat.
But generally speaking, poems that are fairly similar in style to my first book.
All right. I look forward to taking a look. And I think you've kind of already answered the question, but when I gave you my list of questions, you wanted to throw in to be asked what inspires you. So you have answered it many times over, but maybe you can answer it again in a more sort of like, almost like a guiding light way.
Yes, I think I did answer it, and I would like to add to that answer that my poetry represents a way for me not only to connect with other people, but to find myself. I won't give my age, but I definitely have lived for a number of decades, and I'm still searching for myself. I'm still trying to find myself. I'm trying to find not only myself, but this collection of selves, and to facilitate the interaction and communication among these different parts of me or collections of myself. So that inspires me too. Sometimes a part of me needs to speak, I'll put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
I feel a part of me needs to speak, and that might inspire a poem.
Part of why I like doing these interviews is because it's sort of like writing, where something comes out of it while doing it that was not, you know, not planned or not thought of before. So like in this case, you know, just talking about the psychology and the poetics and the line, you know, where's the line between arts and madness? And it's like, they, you know, there may be things I've thought about, but in conversation, things come out, you know, that just to amplify or clarify in different ways. So, you know, that's why it's healthy, good for people to, you know, why people do get out and like to share their work with other people, because it, you know, we can bounce off each other in a good way.
Definitely.
So do you want to... Anything else you want to wrap up saying, and maybe finish up with a poem?
By
the
way,
the book "Call Them Home" is available on the All Book Books website, and it's 96 pages. It's chock full of a lot of interesting stuff.
Thank you, Monk. Yeah. Yes, I would like to.
You mentioned Damaris, or did you have another one you wanted to pick up?
I have another poem that I'd like to read, to say. That one of the things that inspires me the most is nature.
Okay.
And you know that my book is dedicated to, I don't use the term, but to Mother Nature, mm-hmm. the natural world, mm-hmm. oceans, forests, flowers, trees, and all living beings. Recently, I felt very inspired by trees, and I'd like to read a poem that is not in the book, but I'm hoping will be in my next book.
Okay.
It was inspired by an experience with a tree.
Okay.
And it's called Gushing Out. Entranced by a tall maple in the strong wind, my watching it at a red light seemed endless, and the inmost parts nearest the trunk were opening themselves up as my inner wanted. Oh, like a hidden vessel. In being revealed, the liquid becomes golden, ambrosia, apple light, and passive to the wind. Can let itself fall outward and trust. A waterfall filigreed in the breeze, freed from holding on. Not a human who so longs to let go and be outward, not hold inside. Shadows gone, strings, ropes, containers opened, cut free as a multicolored kite lifts, and passing by, I thank the supple limbs for the revelation just in front of me that sweep me away in their stream.
Nice. I'm going to have to read that again because there's such passion in the poem that I kind of got like swept up in the emotion. And so my mind sort of turned off on some of the words, which is, you know, hey, why it's great to hear poets, and it's also great to have books. So we can balance the two, because like I said, I'd have to read it again to be like, what was he talking about? But but you don't always have to, you know, one of the things with poetry is you don't always have to sort of quote get it. You know, I could hear that poem and walk away with this really joyful feeling that I, you know, that you were able to put into some words, and, you know, and that can be good enough. You know, of course, you know, you as a poet, you want me to look it over and say, oh, this line and that line.
Yes.
And, you know, that's natural. But I think, as, you know, people to appreciate and listen to poetry, is it's as much about the feeling, you know, as it is about the words. So.
Yes.
So thank you, Greg. Thanks for putting so much feeling into your words and, you know, sharing so much. I enjoyed this conversation more than interview very much.
Thank you, Monk. So did I.
All right. And good luck with the keeping on with the arts and self-discovery.
Thanks again.
And we'll go out with a few minutes from Symphony No. 2 by Joseph Alexander, Greg's father. And he was quite the accomplished composer. This, you can listen to all of it on YouTube. This is... from a world premiere performance, 1965, at Carnegie Hall. And the description, New York Times description wrote that his music was, quote, full of graceful good humor and whimsical metric changes. It was music that never hurried, never took itself too seriously, and never failed to endear.
Symphony No. 2 of Joseph Alexander. Thank you.
Thank you.